A lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity.com, joining you this evening and every evening, every Saturday evening rather, once a week to provide you with education, enlightenment, and entertainment regarding the aftermath of crime and all the issues that surround it. And this evening, we're very blessed to have a crime victim family, which we haven't had for quite a while, so this is really a treat. And it's a family who has roots in Connecticut, so that's dear to my heart, and it is a cold case. And so we are going to try to create awareness so that we might be able to assist this family in getting some extra clues and perhaps some help to get some resolution. And before I share the details, I want to bring in Delilah, good evening, and how are you this evening, and what's on your mind?
Well, I think this is another wonderful show you've got planned with some great guests. You know, being that we're looking and examining a cold case tonight, and the family members are here to speak about it. And I think, you know what, it's the weekend of miracles, okay? So who knows? Who knows? The listeners out there, maybe someone has the key. Maybe someone has the key to open that last clue so that it might give this family some resolution and some answers to their case so they know what happened.
Yes, definitely, Delilah. I do. I'm very excited about doing this. I wrote sort of sarcastically right online, I feel a little bit like Susan Murphy Milano because this is what she used to do on her show all the time at Crime Wire. And although I can't...
Well, maybe, you know, we can be fire starters here, because that's exactly what we did when Susan and I did her show. It was, you know, we had cases like this come to us, and we were able to start that little fire that got movement. And some of them, you know, have gotten a lot of movement over the years just because of one radio show. So you never know.
Yes, yes, and that it could be, you never know. So, and we think positive around here, so we're going to try in any case. Let me give people a little bit of information. Ryan Ulbrich is our guest, and he is the son of Leah Ulbrich, who is the person who was tragically murdered in 1995. Ryan, at the time of the murder, was 12 years old.
Five years old.
Okay, yeah. That's, I'm sorry, I'm reading. I guess we have a typo there. Thank you very much. You were five. And so what we do know for sure that you are a recent graduate of Eastern Connecticut State University with your degree in criminology and sociology, correct, Ryan?
Yes, that's correct.
That's wonderful, and I'm thinking that this may have served as an inspiration for your major. And to not know and to not have answers and be that small and that innocent and to have this happen to your family, as a homicide survivor, I just have to say I know that it's absolutely devastating, but I was an adult when this happened. So I want to thank you for for doing what you're doing in your mom's memory. And we also have the privilege of having your grandfather here. And since he just got on the line, I'm going to give you the honors of introducing him because I do not have the details. So please do introduce him.
Sure. My grandfather's name is Robert Baskin. He lives in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. And he's been he's a professional. He's done a lot of things in his life. He graduated Middlebury College. He'd probably be better at introducing himself, but he's worked closely.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Baskin, and I am very, very happy that you have seen fit to ask us about our my daughter's case and to have Ryan here, who has been a stalwart in trying to understand what happened, as well as trying to take steps to uncover any information that might lead to solving this very brutal murder from 1995, October 29th, 1995, as a matter of fact. I was born and brought up in Middletown. My mother, my daughter, and I were all born in the same hospital at Middlesex Memorial Hospital in Middletown. I grew up there, went to Middletown High School, went away to college in Vermont, as Ryan has indicated, but then came back, taught in Old Saybrook before I went back to graduate school, and have been living in Washington, D.C. area since 1991, where I came down to the area in order to be chief of staff to former Congressman Sam Gaydenson from Eastern Connecticut.
Oh, really? Okay.
And interestingly, I currently president of a nonprofit called the Peace Alliance, which works to change people's attitudes and communities and nations even regarding conflict and violence. And we work very hard to try to provide alternatives, positive alternatives, because they do exist to some of the more punitive, militaristic, and incarcerating approaches that are proposed by too many people and too many interest groups that exist today. So
That's
my rough background.
Well, very good. That's very intriguing, and you know, perhaps I'm sure we can put a link up to your organization when I do the blog. I'd be happy to. That sounds very good. Yeah. Now, let's see. Why don't we start at the beginning to give us a little bit of background? Now, from a father's perspective, can you tell us what your daughter was like in terms of her personality, her interests, her early growing up, and, you know, what went on in terms of that?
Yeah,
you
Leah,
have a
Leah
stronger
was a
memory.
Fascinating little kid. She was, A, very, very, very smart. She's obviously passed the genes on to Ryan and his sister, Abby, who's a student at, I think, Gateway Community College, as we speak. But
Great.
She was a multi-talented kid, as Ryan is, in the sense that she did stained glass, she wrote poetry, she was athletic, she had a variety of interests. She had everything going for her, but she got into drugs and suffered for a long time, dealt with it for a long time, had a very difficult time dealing with drugs, and it progressed from, you know, marijuana up through the whole panoply
very hardcore
of drugs, unfortunately. But she went to programs, and in the last year of her life, she stayed clean. She finished up at a full program in Portland, Connecticut, and was on her way really to being able to deal with her addiction. And we were very proud of her. But somehow she got into the wrong place at the wrong time and was brutally murdered. I don't know whether you have articulated any of the details of it, but basically...
No, not yet. No, we wanted to hear some background first in terms of who she was as a person and how you would describe her, as well as Ryan. And I know, Ryan, if you were only five at the time. What are your memories?
Well,
of your mom?
Obviously, I'm not going to have very many memories.
Many.
But to be honest, coming from a background that you hear somebody like my mother, who is very heavy into drugs, a lot
right.
of people out there would assume that the memories that I had as a child were bad, and that's actually not true for me. As much as I can remember of her, I just remember really her smile, and
mm-hmm.
it's just a really the warmest motherly smile that you could have. And I have this one funny memory of her where I used to play video games. I still do, but when I was 5 years old, I had the old blocky, bulgy Game Boy, and I had Super Mario for that. And we went to visit her one day at one of the rehabs that she went to, and she convinced me to trade her a Super Mario for a Tetris. A trade to this day I think was unfair because she took Super Mario from me, but either way, that's a good memory that I have and that
yeah.
I cherish, because as 5 years old, they're not going to remember much. So.
Yeah.
I could provide a memory that Ryan probably doesn't remember. My
yeah.
daughter unfortunately got started early with drugs and the like, but when she found out that she was pregnant with Ryan, her first child, she went clean for 2 or 3 years, and I have these memories of her. She was a terrific, terrific mother. She loved Ryan. She loved Ryan very much. She used
mm-hmm.
to roll around on the floor with him. She would talk with him, play with him, take him places. I mean, she was just an ideal mother.
Mm-hmm.
And then unfortunately, you know, she slipped back after that for a variety of reasons that I won't really even go into.
Was she
was just terrific. Sorry?
Bob, was she enrolled in school at any point, you know, in like community college, or was she trying to sit on a career path with any of those talents that she had?
Well, she had not gotten to the point of going to college. She was in high school, in a variety of different high schools as she went into different programs. I mean, she worked very hard, and to be frank, you know, her mother and I worked very, very hard to try to give her the support that she needed, from counselors to programs to so on. As unfortunately is still the case today, there mm-hmm. is a lack of facilities that really can deal with kids who have the sickness of addiction. It is not a crime, although it gets treated as such far too often.
Right.
Interestingly enough, you know, in the United States, we have 5% of the world's population, and we have 25% of all of the world's prisoners. And the preponderance of those prisoners are all for drug-related events, and it's wrong. We really should have many, many, many more facilities to deal with an illness as opposed to treating it like a crime. But
right.
She did not go
you.
To college at I should tell you, and I don't have a problem in saying this, she was measured. She had 138 IQ. This was not a dumb, lazy kid.
Uh-huh.
She just got caught up in the drugs, and it has had a terrific hold on her.
Do you think because of her high intellect, maybe she was just bored with whatever and she started experimenting?
It could be. I can remember when it first started, and it was really she started hanging around with some of the probably wrong people. Not that they were
right.
necessarily bad, but they were the wrong people for her because they introduced her to this.
Right.
And you know, it built on from there. But I want to emphasize, the last year of her life, she completed the program. She was very proud of being clean. She was trying very, very, very hard, and it was just too much. And as I said, she ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Was it do you feel either of you was it a crime with the circumstances? Was it a crime of opportunity? You know, she's walking down the street, whatever.
Well,
and the,
well. I can actually, I feel like I can answer that question.
Okay.
But the nature of her crime, she was dragged for 4 miles.
Right. But how did she get to meet up with this person? Did they stop her?
That's my theory is that, I mean, no one knows for sure, but with a crime like that, I would say it was a crime of opportunity. You're not going to plan out dragging someone by a car like that, at least with the way it was. Whatever the man decided to do, from my own deduction, is she probably knew him. She might have maybe relapsed again. Mm-hmm. Whatever it may be, it was, in my opinion, a crime of opportunity. But I believe that she
She was sitting in a car with his children, and as Ryan has indicated, we don't really know the motivation for how she got into the car. But what happened is apparently they had some sort of dispute, and he pushed her outside, out of the door on the passenger side, and she got her arm caught in the seatbelt. And he peeled away and drove from Hartford to Wethersfield, where Leah finally fell off of the seatbelt, and that's where she was found in near Jordan Lane in Wethersfield.
Mm-hmm. Right,
but he physically pushed her out of the car, and we know that because there were some witnesses. There was a woman who apparently witnessed this. She called into the police through a call box that was in the area in Hartford. And the police tried hard to get her to call back in, but they were never able to identify her. There was also an off-duty policeman who apparently saw some of this, perhaps toward the end of the disagreement, and saw the car peel off, and he maintained that he wasn't able to turn around fast enough to track.
He claims he wasn't able to catch up to the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Has anything ever been discovered about the driver of the car?
They had a couple of witnesses.
Complexion of him, what he might have looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had some description of the car. They thought it was a dark brown or a blue, either Nissan or Toyota or something of that ilk. They thought that he had a darker, at least it was reported by some of the witnesses, he had a darker complexion. I don't know the degree of that darkness. There was some
hair.
Of that.
Also, I was informed
it looked more Hispanic than African American, to be frank. But
I also was informed by a police officer that there might have been a New York license plate on the car.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also informed there was a partial license plate that they got, but I was never told what it was. And the police officer I talked to recently claimed, and it might have just been his opinion, that they believed that it possibly could have been a rental car or something of that sort. But I was told that there was possibly a New York plate on it.
So the car might have been fairly new as a rental car?
During that time, I would believe that. They said that it was newer model, 94, 95 Nissan Maxima something along the lines of that.
Now, when she was pushed from the car and got caught up in the seatbelt, did she ultimately, I saw that she was found at the curb and that she was, the medical examiner diagnosed it as blunt force trauma. Do you believe that she hit her head on the curb and that's what caused the trauma?
No,
she was dragged.
Because of the dragging.
She hit her head and the brutal part was she actually had wires in her hand or something in her hand, so she wasn't knocked out. She was alive throughout the whole ordeal until, I guess, her soul finally left her body.
My goodness. How far, Bob or Ryan, how far was she dragged, actually? Was it a 4 miles?
Four miles main road in the morning.
She was hanging on for 4 miles?
I'm assuming she just couldn't get her arm out. To get her arm out.
It was no one should have to go through that. I mean, Leah was at heart. You know, she you know, we had a ceremony at the facility in Portland that she had graduated from and completed in the program, and we there was a plaque that was erected as we donated, the family donated funding so that they could open up a library for the clients, the patients, to be able to see DVDs at the time or tapes at the time or books at the time that related to that might help them with their recovery. And basically the plaque said, and it was really reflective of the way Leah was, she cared more about others than she did about herself.
So they have a library there and have erected a plaque in her name. That's wonderful. That's very, very nice. With regard to some of the other things, now when she was dragged, it said that there was some type of residual liquid or a trail of liquid that they could see. Does anyone know if that was analyzed at all? Or
Well, it was basically her blood.
That was her own bodily fluid, I'm assuming, her blood. And
it was basically her
urine.
They did, the cold case people and or the Hartford Police Department, who originally had the case, did try to identify DNA that was present in under Leah's fingernails, but they felt that at the time there was insufficient amounts or insufficient technology to have it very valuable. You know, I know the technology on DNA has gone.
So wait, do they still have evidence then, Grandpa?
I don't know. It may be in the cold. You'd have to ask the cold case people whether there is any sufficient amount that is still left. There also, as Leah, as Ryan pointed out, and I don't, you know, we're not going to specify exactly, but there was something that she had in her hand that came out that only the murderer would know about, and that's why they haven't divulged it, so that, you know, if and when they ever get a sufficient clue to identify, they would have that as a link to the individual who did this stupid thing.
Well, Delilah, isn't it true? I mean, nowadays, they only need a very small amount of DNA a lot of times to try to analyze, and that was, what, almost like 19 years ago?
Well, that was my question, and you may not know the answer, but was the fact that have they preserved that evidence sample of DNA somewhere. So, you know, as technology increases, that evidence could be processed in a different way and give them the answer they're looking for.
And that's exactly when I was doing my own investigations into it. I contacted the police department at least 20 times trying to get bits of information. And I don't mean to point fingers, because I'm sure they tried their best. The chief of police was the investigator, Ravella, and was in contact with my grandfather and tried his best, he says. But there just seems to me now that there could be something more that they can do. I got stonewalled, and I guess I can see maybe why they wouldn't want to give me all information. But
Have you used the Freedom of Information Act to get case file information?
I went to try and do that, but when I looked up the exceptions to the rule, when a police, and this was created especially, what the FCC told me was that, or sorry, the Freedom of Information Act told me was that when, because of the Sandy Hook shooting, there's a lot of documents that they didn't want to give to the public. So if they label a case as ongoing, they can put it, they don't have to give any information out.
Okay.
It is still an active case. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that they did do a more updated DNA testing of the DNA, but that was probably, I don't know, 5-6 years after the original crime. Five or six years. But, it all comes down to the to the forensic lab. You know,
right.
Henry Lee used to be the head of the forensic lab. He's gone on to other things.
Delilah and I have friends at Henry Lee Institute, too. So, and we've had a few of them on this show as well. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we can have a conversation. I'm not making any promises. But, I mean, it's always good to know people, you know, from these types of places. In fact, we did a two-hour special down there. But it just seems to me, yes, and with whatever object, because I think you mentioned something about wires, Ryan, and whatever the object
was. Well, she had something in her hand that I was told possibly could have been some wires.
Other kind of injuries or marks on her hand, or he gotten some other kind of material on there, you know. I'm just wondering about that as well. And can you take us through what was your initial experience with law enforcement in terms of the timeline? Because many people have good experiences, but many people have horrible, and there are those in between. It's always beneficial to our audience to know what happened in terms of the sequence of what they did, or, you know.
It was originally with the Hartford Police Department, because the initial crime happened in Hartford. Detective Jim Ravella, whom I have the utmost respect for, I think he is ultimately become the chief, or was the chief in Hartford. But he was the lead investigator, or lead detective in the Hartford Police Department. He kept me fully informed. He was very sensitive. I have nothing but praise for Ravella. When he left the Hartford Police Department initially, he moved over to the cold case, to the state's attorney's office with the cold case group, and he ultimately became the lead investigator for the cold case, and he kept this thing alive. You know, there is a $50,000 reward government came up, and he was helpful in getting that, getting the governor to declare that reward for Leah. So I have nothing
and that is
but
still valid,
respect
right?
for Ravella.
And that's still valid.
It is still valid. Very
okay.
much valid. The other thing that has happened, you know, and there have been several subsequent investigators in the cold case division over at the state's attorney's office, but several years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, the state of Connecticut instituted a program that had been successful in the state of Florida and perhaps in a couple of other jurisdictions. And what it entails is, you know, many of the incarcerated offenders like to play cards. And what the state has done is said, you may only use a certain set of cards. You may not have outside cards brought in. And the cards that you may use are 52 cold cases where you see a picture on the front of the victim and a little description on the back of what really went on. And Leah was chosen as one of those 52 cases, and she still is on the deck
we
of cards.
We have that posted online, Bob. We have that
that's
posted
terrific.
On the, yeah.
That's terrific.
It's the Three of Clubs, correct?
I think so. I think it is. It's one of the clubs. But they, you know, they also, you know, all of the folks in law enforcement with whom I've spoken, and Ryan has talked to many more, it's admirable that he has pursued this in such an aggressive way, in a positively aggressive way, that they believe that the best hope, you never know, but the best hope, they believe, will come from somebody who is in trouble, who is either incarcerated or soon to be incarcerated, that wants to trade information, that may know something about what happened admittedly now 18 years ago. And that's where they really are still hopeful, and that's why I guess we are still hopeful that eventually we can get some resolution.
For some reason they couldn't talk, and now with all the passage of time maybe they can. What I was also wondering about was, you know, if she had unfortunately gotten into the drug culture, and again I'm not being judgmental here. I have no idea how she might have support her habit, but did they talk to conceivably everyone that she might have hung out with in terms of those that she traded drugs with, other people that they had known, the hangouts that she might have frequented, all of those kinds of things. All of those were, you know, interviewed and re-interviewed, that kind of thing?
To my knowledge, they attempted to interview anybody and everybody. They tried to find that woman who called in. They interviewed the off-duty policeman who indicated that he was unable to catch up with the car. And they interviewed, some friends or associates. I don't know how extensive it was. I don't know whether they talked to everyone. I kind of doubt that they probably were able to even identify everyone with whom she had had some sort of dealings with. But to my knowledge, they made an attempt. You know, it unfortunately hasn't been successful.
Mm-hmm. And let's see, in 1995, she was 24?
Yes, she's born on January 18th, 1971. And
okay, so it's nearly 20 years later. All of those people would have been, you know, that much older, and I'm just, you know, wondering can you tell us a bit about what, did she really have a home life? I mean, in between when she was in and out of rehab, my understanding from talking to Ryan, is it true that, Ryan, you stayed with your grandparents while she was in rehab programs, or did she try to have her own apartment in between, or what? Tell us about that a little bit.
You want me to answer that, Ryan?
Well, I mean, I've lived with my grandmother since I was 3, and, up until I went to college and everything, and boarding school,
okay.
But I know that she would come back every now and again and hang out with us, but as for where she lived, I don't know.
She was basically in residential facilities, multiple residential facilities for treatment. She never had her own apartment. She did move back in with her mother and with Ryan and Abby, the two kids, periodically and for short. I think that is certainly in that last year. I know probably from, I'm gonna guess a little bit, but probably from March until August, when she finally left her mother's house again. Maybe it was in September, but basically, other than living in with her mother periodically for short periods of time, she was in residential facilities.
And that is, of course, after her and my father split up, because before that,
right,
they did have a place together.
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you know, like you had said, Bob, that this past year was a relatively good year because she was clean and sober, she was getting her act together and all of that.
Yeah.
Do you know of any particular stressor that she somehow might have gotten in contact with some of her old haunts or people that she used to hang out with, and that maybe helped, you know, was the influence to this? Or do you feel, Bob, it was just by chance that, you know, she had an encounter with somebody, got in the car, and they had an argument? Do you think it's actually somebody that she knew that she might have recontacted, or it was just happenstance?
I honestly don't know for sure. I don't know if what triggered her, you know, when she left at the end of August from her mother's house. Frankly, I was surprised. I saw her again in September. As a matter of fact, we had a terrific lunch, and I know that a few weeks after that, Ryan and Abby and their grandmother actually got together with Leah one more time. So it I don't have the details of what
right.
prompted her to do it. I think that, you know, when Drugs are a crazy thing. You know, some people are susceptible to it, and some people aren't. And some people, I think at one point or another, she did get involved with crack, and I think crack as I understand it, is one of the worst substances that you could abuse, because for a lot of people, once you try crack even once, you are really, really, really vulnerable. And Leah just had that sort of personality that made her vulnerable.
It was so addictive, yeah. Yeah, that's sure. I can understand that. What else occurred? I know that initially it was just the Hartford police that were working on this, and then was this part of a task force after that, or they combined forces? Because I understand she had also lived in New Britain. Was Hartford police involved, New Britain, and some other law enforcement?
No, she had been, it's interesting in that a couple of years before she was murdered, she happened to be in New Britain, for what I don't know, but she was attacked and beaten pretty severely and ended up in the hospital, but she came out of that
situation. She was in a coma.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, she was in the intensive care unit there for quite a while.
She was beaten in the back of the head, and they don't even know who did that.
But as
Grandpa would say after, she came out of it a different person because she sustained massive brain damage.
She did. Okay, so she had a traumatic brain injury as a result of this attack.
Yeah, she ended up doing rehab at Gaylord in Wallace.
Oh my goodness! So when was that? When did that attack occur?
In 93, I believe it was 92 or
93. 92. So I'll put on my speech pathology hat. I used to be. I'm just hypothesizing that perhaps after that, you don't always have the best of judgment.
No.
And there's many cognitive skills and thinking skills and your ability to make decisions and judgment, even if you are that intelligent, that if she was severely impaired, that maybe she made the wrong decision with, going with this particular person or whatnot. So, that could be a key too, that time period between 93 and 95. So you weren't really able to track too much about, what was going on in that period?
Well, what you say could sounds very logical. What I would add, however, is that subsequent to New Britain, she entered the program at Elmcrest in Portland and finished it and completed it and went clean. I'm not certain whether her decision-making processes were impaired or not. It's not illogical that it may have been. But on the other hand, part of her decision-making process to say, I'm going to stick with it this time and go through this program, and it was at least a six-month program, and she completed it.
Well, there's many different types of skills and abilities depending upon the particular area of the brain that we use. So I think it sounded like she's very intelligent, very motivated kind of person, but it could be separate and distinct from, some other kinds of decisions she would have to make, if she was out on the street versus doing a very structured program with activities and monitoring and that kind of thing. I'm just, throwing that out there.
No, you're probably right.
I would agree with you on that.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the emotional turmoil must have been awful. Can you tell us a little bit about how you received word, what were the circumstances, and, the follow-up after her death? Was there someone in your family that ultimately took charge? And, this must have been such a shock.
Yeah, I did.
After she was doing so well.
I did. I got a call on Sunday night.
Yes.
At about 9:30 in the evening on October 29th. And it was from the Hartford Police Department, and They told me that my daughter had been murdered at about 5:30 in the morning, or somewhere around that time, that morning, and they told me a little bit about what had happened. It was a pretty horrendous time. I got in my car the next morning, or I can't remember even now whether I flew up to New York and then picked up a rental car, or whether I drove, because I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. And I drove up and started to make all of the arrangements with funeral home and the cemetery and the like. And then later that day, I had to talk to Ryan and Abby, who were 5 and 3 at the time. And I remember...
I actually remember that, too.
I know.
I remember everyone crying.
We were downstairs in their grandmother's apartment, and I had to tell them that their mother was not going to come back. And I remember saying, and I think Ryan, being 5 as opposed to 3, probably understood a little bit more than his sister did. But I said to them that even though their mother wasn't coming back, that they should know that a part of her was in each of them.
Right.
Yeah.
And that they would always have part of her with them.
Yeah.
And that was one of the, you know, I get lots of speeches, and I, over the years I've given, and I still do lots of speeches, and I'm on panels, and I'm in, give radio interviews and TV interviews and the like. That was one of the hardest speaking engagements that I ever had.
Yeah, and I just if you want to talk about emotional turmoil, I mean, the only person that I haven't really seen, so I grew up with my sister and my grandmother, and my sister is still messed up from it. She gets emotional about a lot of things, and it's because I believe she didn't have a mother, and I had to overcome so many things. I grew up, not only did my mother die, my father died when I was 12 as well, and it's been hard to grow up and have to take the reins of my life when I could just have given people excuses, and no one really would have doubted me. They'd say, "Yeah, well, why do you do this?" And I'd say, "Well, I don't have parents. Do you have parents?"
Yeah.
And they'd be like,
"But you have it. You've risen above it. You are resilient, like I am, like many crime victims are, Ryan. And I applaud you.
Thank you. It
must have been absolutely awful, but it sounds like, you know, your grandparents were, now I'm not sure about your grandmother. How is she doing right now?
My grandmother, you know, I'm going to be honest, hasn't been able to reel from the pain, and she goes through a day-to-day basis, and I'm not going to dwell into her life because it's irrelevant. However, she has not been the same, and I'll tell you that from right now. Major depression issues, possibly maybe alcohol as well, and that's a lot of people, they do that. They can't get over aspects of a death, and maybe that's because they wish they did something differently or whatever her thing is. It's the only reason, I firmly believe the only reason why my grandmother is standing right now alive and not dead is because Abby and my sister Abby and I are alive. She tells me that.
That's absolutely
She says, "If you were the only reason that I were to live, if you were to die, I would kill myself." And that is because of the pain that she felt from losing my mother. And that's the loss that our family faces. And I guess it gets worse with the years because we have to tell ourselves that one day her killer will be found when likelihood suggests he probably won't. However, I don't, and I know my grandfather does not, we don't believe that. We tell ourselves that though that the possibility of the guy being found is very unlikely, but still a possibility. It's not impossible. And anyone that deals with a death like that should understand that. And if you doubt it, then look at Kathy Hardy out of Brantford, a woman who was murdered in her own house. They set it on fire, just found the two killers who did that, and more is being uncovered. And that was a cold case that was going on for, what, 6 to 8 years? They're very lovely people. I've met them, by the way. And they told me they people in our position need to stay strong because that's what our loved ones would have wanted.
So the police at this point in time, or the police that you've been dealing with, do not feel that this case is solvable? Did they give you a reason?
Well, they give...
Did they say there's
well,
not enough evidence?
Well, I know recently I talked to them. They don't have any leads. They don't have names. And they don't really know how to proceed, I'm guessing, for whatever reason. I've even tried to be in contact with, well, I know my grandfather tried, America's Most Wanted. I was trying to get on the show Cold Justice, and unfortunately, all those shows need law enforcement approval. And if they don't give the approval, then they're never going to be on the show. So they could have evidence all they want. If they don't feel like it fits their case and their motive, you're not going to get the word out there, as well as maybe other people. Maybe even people. Go on.
Have they tried to link your mom's case to any other similar cases of similar circumstances, around that same time frame?
I would have
other
no
people
that
were
that.
Drug addicted and, you know, might have been in harm's way.
I have no answer to that. I don't know.
You're not sure.
They might have done that. I mean, I know I got a heads up that there was a case of corruption that was going on during that time, and that was the only thing I got from it. I'm sure maybe they tried to link up certain things, but I mean, I have no idea. That's the problem with a lot of police work nowadays, is that I feel like, and I don't mean to put it out there, but I feel like sometimes people are left behind. And I feel left behind sometimes because I know there's more that can be done, but it's an old case. And I guess people are going to be like, well, you know, what's the point? I don't know. But
well, I think you shouldn't give up. I think there are certain things that you can do, perhaps that don't cost money. I know to hire other private investigators costs a lot of money. But, you know, with use of social media as well, too, I think maybe you could also use that to your advantage. Let me ask each of you, because you might have a different goal in coming on. Like, Bob, what
yep.
would be your short-term goal in terms of what would you like to see accomplished with this? Do you want, I'll just throw some things out there. Do you want to see if perhaps you could get a PI to help you pro bono? Do you want to get more national media attention and appear on other shows? Do you want do you want someone to pick up the cause to take another reexamination on the DNA, whether it be people at Henry Lee's or otherwise? What is it that you would want if you had a wish list, a reasonable wish list?
I think the last two items that you mentioned, I mean, if there is sufficient and it has been preserved evidence from the materials that they gathered, that the new technologies of DNA could perhaps shed some light, that would be wonderful. I think public attention is always a good thing. You know, right after this happened and for several years after this happened, I came up to Connecticut, back to Connecticut, and gave TV interviews, you know, with Channel 8 and Channel 3. Maybe even Channel 30, but you know, I believe in letting people know what's out there. You never know who may recall something, and I'd certainly be in favor of that.
I also would be
what
in favor
think,
of
Ryan?
That. I would honestly be in favor for any help that generous people would like to give to us, because I mean, just I know without people's help, I'm not going to be able to solve this by myself. I was hoping that not even just from this, but maybe someone is out there listening right now and they would like to help, or they know somebody that would let us speak on maybe a Dr. Phil show, or maybe even someone who'd be like, you know, maybe we can get some more evidence together and put it on a cold case show. That would be a hope for me, because then at least you'd be able to get people all across the country to see that and go, oh my God, how awful, those poor people, maybe we can help them further. Once you get attention nationally to any issue, it takes off on its own. That's what people like.
And we've proven that time and time again, and we know people that has happened to. And perhaps getting a Facebook page saying, help Leah Albrecht or something of that nature. Delilah, if you were brainstorming and with all the hundreds of cases and radio shows that you've done with Susan, what other thoughts come to mind with regard to this case?
Well, as far as national media attention, it's something that you have to build gradually in most cases, not always, but it's something that you have to be consistent with, and you have to build gradually. Coming on a show like this one is definitely a great step in the right direction, and you should look for other shows like this that maybe aren't using celebrity hosts and national hosting, but there's a lot of them. There's tons of internet radio shows that have discussion. And that's what it's all about, is people having discussion and you getting your message defined very, very clearly. When you come on a show, you have to, depending on how much time is allowed to you, because a lot of times it's not going to be an hour, it's going to be very short. So you have to have your message very defined. What are you focusing on here? Get on, say it, get it out there, and time that you're allowed. The more your message will stay the same, okay? But your audience is going to change. Your audience from each show that you do, whether it be something like this or local television, I always say start out in your own backyard. Start out where this crime happened, and people remember your mother, remember the incident,
the area where
exactly the area where it happened. They tend to jog people's memories, and you don't know that person that has the clue could be right in your own backyard, and you just haven't remembered it yet.
There are people I did an internship recently with the survivors of homicide out of Connecticut.
Yes, I was just going to ask you about your affiliation with them. What's that about?
Well, I did an internship with them, so I helped try to build a New Haven support group, which ultimately it wasn't successful. However, I tried my very hardest with that. But basically, I was an intern. I talked to recent victims' families, told them that we were out there, and it's hard. It was very hard talking to them, because not only did it bring up memories with me, but most of them didn't even want to talk to me. They're upset, and it's understandable. However, when I went to some support groups, there was one in particular where I told my story, and a man goes, oh, my God, I remember that. Oh, I'm so sorry for you.
Yeah.
That's just one out of thousands of people out there that remember my mother. And they remember her not in a light of, oh, what a good person. They remember what a brutal tragedy and horrible that was. And they did what a lot of people do, is they move on because it didn't affect them. But it's affected my life. And people should really understand that we're humans and we can all band together to help people.
I'd just like to finish up with the following thought. You know, Leah was an absolutely caring and terrific person who admittedly succumbed to the illness of addiction. But nobody, I mean nobody, even bad people, deserve to be murdered in such a brutal horrific way. And the other piece is that it wasn't just Leah who was murdered. That event has affected a whole number of other people, from her mother to her brother to her son to her daughter to her grandfather.
It's a domino effect.
Her father.
Yes.
I mean, and, mm-hmm. and those of us and those that know us, it's not just one person who was brutally murdered. It was all of us.
Yeah, a little part of all of us died that day. And I'll never get that back.
Yes.
I don't even know what the future would have been like with her.
I can relate. Bob, I just wanted to share with you, and I don't know if Ryan knew about it. Thursday, well, a week ago or so, was the National Crime Victims Rights Week, and I was in Washington, D.C. for that. Oh. And Thursday was the 33rd anniversary of my father's murder in Hartford.
Yeah.
So
I'm very sorry.
Thank you. And, you know, so all those years later, and it still does hurt, but I
Absolutely.
Feel that the best way to go on is to continue doing positive things to help other people, and to
yeah.
not dwell on it, because it sounds like your daughter and your mother would not want you to dwell on the negative aspects. They would want you to move on. But and that brings me to the fact, because we have about 5.5 minutes or so. Ryan, tell us about your future aspirations. You're a major in sociology and criminal justice, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
So what is it that you're
that
working on?
I have a lot of goals that I've wanted to, and they've ultimately changed because, you know, I'm young. We do that. We change our minds.
Yes.
Ultimately, what I learned from every experience that I went through is that, especially with my studies in sociology, it really clicked with me. People are inherently, I believe it, that they don't inherit bad things. It's really just experiences. So my ultimate goal is to help people. I've decided recently that I'm going to go back to grad school. I'm looking at UConn, Southern Connecticut right now, possibly
uh-huh.
even Quinnipiac, into
uh-huh.
getting my MSW. And I really want to be
wow.
a clinical therapist for children who have experienced the same tragedy that, or similar tragedies that I have.
Oh, my goodness. I so applaud you. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So that's a huge milestone in your career path, and it is so needed. It really, really is.
And I just realized through everything that I went through that I can do it, and so can the people. Anyone can overcome something bad. It's just they have to realize that even though they overcome it to get to a better place, it's still a part of them.
Right.
And I want to help people like that.
You want to help people. And Bob, what are you doing current? I know you have the nonprofit, but is there anything in particular that you're trying to do proactively? I know it's been all these years, but with regard to your daughter in this case, if we get this out here, it's national, it's in our archives for repeated listening, we send it on social media, maybe you can help your grandson with setting up a Facebook page. There is a fundraising site where you can raise money. We could tell you about that. Perhaps if you raise more money, you could get, no, not Kickstarter, it's called Indiegogo, is that what it is, Delilah?
Okay.
Yeah, and there's several out there that
you could do. There's several out there you could use. I mean, if funds are the deterrent to getting another private investigator, and I know they're very expensive, perhaps that could be another way as well. You could do simultaneously. And I'd like to ask that, you know, that the two of you stay in contact with me, because, you know, perhaps we'd like to know any updates, or if there's something, you know, even of a small nature that we can do to put you in touch with certain people that we may know, because of, you know, I've been doing this radio show for over 2 years, so I have met many people in Connecticut, you know, that
yeah,
may...
Right.
So anyway, go ahead, Dwight.
Well, no, we both, I know, appreciate everything you and Delilah have given us in the opportunity to speak about Leah. You know, I've tried to live my life moving in only one direction, and that is forward. And I felt it was important when Leah passed away. I knew that Ryan and Abby absolutely positively needed my support, and I worked very hard to try to provide mm-hmm. that and still do. I live my life today
by trying to give back, and it's in honor of and in memory of my daughter. While I move forward, I think of her every day. Her picture is on my bedstand. I mean, I see her every single day. But what I try to do, and when I had the opportunity and was asked to take over this nonprofit that, that deals with at-risk kids and gang violence and intervention, it was so appropriate. When Newtown happened, I woke up the next morning, Saturday morning, got on my computer and wrote a piece about what I felt about and why I felt I had some credibility, having been born and brought up in Connecticut and knew the Newtown area, and then having lost our daughter. And that got put out to our 60, 70,000 grassroots network.
Wonderful.
It's now been published in about a quarter of a million pieces.
Wonderful. That's so great. Well, if you maybe you can share off air, because we have to go. We'll include some contact information if you would like, Bob and Ryan. And we wish you all the best, and we will do
Thank
a blog for tomorrow. So we're going to have to say good evening for now. And thank you so much for being our guest. It was a real pleasure. And
thank
we'll talk to you off air. Okay?
Yeah.
Thank you, Bob.
So much.
Thank you, Ryan. And we'll speak to you soon. Thank you, Delilah. And thank you, my national audience, for being here. We'll see you next week, same time. Good evening, everyone.